cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser along with Tim Stenovec in our Interactive Brokers studio. Watching shares of the ADRs that trade here in the U.S. of Teva Pharmaceutical, it's down about 3% as we speak. Shares of the Israeli-based generics companies we mentioned under a little bit of pressure following the company's latest quarterly update. The company missing on both the top and bottom lines for the third quarter. And Tim also launching a sustainability-linked bond today, planning to raise $4 billion tied to ESG efforts to increase access to medicines in low and middle income countries. It's something we just talked about.
It is. Kåre Schultz is president and CEO of Teva Pharmaceutical, joining us now from Parsippany, New Jersey. Kåre, it's great to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm very fine, Tim and Carol. It's great to be with you. I'm very fine, thanks.
Well, let's start with the quarter. Carol went through some of the numbers. Why the misses?
Basically, you could say that the expectations that we saw in the marketplace and also the expectations we had at the beginning of the year was that the COVID-19 effects would sort of start to slow down in the second quarter, and then in the third and the fourth quarter, we would basically be back to normal. But what we've seen is that we have seen in Europe a lower volume in the total market in both the first and the second quarter, and then a return towards normality here in the third quarter, but not quite getting there. So we see an improvement in Europe, but it's not quite back to where we thought it would be based on a full normalization. And that's basically because there's still a backlog of people not getting to the doctor, not getting to the specialist, and therefore not going for those prescriptions that we would be expecting they would be going for. It is normalizing. It is getting better. We are optimistic about the fourth quarter that we'll see a further sort of increase in volumes in Europe. So that's really the story on Europe. The story on the U.S. is a little different, but basically the same, that we did not see the specialist opening up in the second quarter the way we were hoping for. So we are very dependent on headache specialists for Ajovy and on psychiatrists for Austedo. And we saw that they were opening up their clinics slower. We are now at the end of the third quarter here. We're getting very close to psychiatrist offices being sort of back to where they would have been at the end of 2019. But that natural growth you see of a couple of percent on patient population and doctor visits, we haven't seen. So we've had a setback in the sense that the growing brands we have, Ajovy for prevention of migraine, Austedo for tardive dyskinesia, and Chorea in Huntington's disease, they are growing nicely, but the growth slowed down in the first and the second quarter. Mm-hmm. So even though they're growing nicely now in the third quarter, the numbers are still below what we hoped for at the beginning of the year.
So
basically, we're optimistic about the growth patterns, but the absolute numbers are probably $100 million below what we were hoping for.
So, Cor, is it by the end of this year, the first quarter of next year, that you anticipate in terms of the numbers that they're back to pre-pandemic levels? When does it happen?
We anticipate that here in the fourth quarter, the numbers in terms of script volumes and the numbers in terms, the normalized numbers, you could say, will be back to pre-pandemic levels here in the fourth quarter of 21.
Oh, okay. All right. And we know, and that's for both of Europe and North America, or one of them, is that for every region? We know the North American market is your biggest market based on revenues.
Both Europe and North America, and it plays a big role for us. So we're really not talking about us not having the right, you know, market shares. We're gaining market shares with Ajovy in Europe. We're gaining market share with Austedo. So we're performing nicely, but the total volume in the market is just lower than what we were hoping for.
Corey, are you confident that people return to the physical doctor's office, the physical psychiatrist's office, to the same degree that they did before the pandemic? Does it ever fully recover with the rise of telemedicine?
I think the number of consultations will fully recover. Some of them will be telemedicine consultations, and that is in principle fine. I mean, the main thing is that people have an in-depth discussion with their psychiatrist or with their headache specialist, because the problem about launching new drugs is that you need to communicate with the specialist. So our sales reps need to communicate with the specialist, and you need the specialist to communicate with the patients in order to get the conversions to the new and better products.
Go ahead, please finish.
And that can happen, of course, on video, and it can happen physically. On average, I would say the conversion rate, or whatever you want to call it, the pull-through, is higher if you have face-to-face conversations between the doctors and the sales force, and if you have face-to-face conversations between the doctor and the patient.
Hey, just got about 40 seconds, then we'll come back and talk some more. In terms of growth engines, once we get kind of back to more normal, do you see a catalyst coming for you guys? Got about 40 seconds, then we'll come back and talk some more. In terms of new drugs that you can put out to the market?
Yeah, it's really more of a Austedo, more of a Ajovy, and then it's the long-acting risperidone LAI that we hope to get approved mid-next year.
All right. And is there a COVID play for you guys?
Not really, not apart from the fact that we are distributing COVID vaccines, for instance, in Israel, and we have a lot of pharmaceuticals that are being used when you treat the sort of effects of COVID in intensive care units and so on. But we don't have a play specifically targeted towards COVID-19.
Hey, Cor, a few things we want to bounce around off of you and just get to that I feel like are outlying issues, if you will, and curious about your view. First of all, earlier this month, you guys had recalled more than 2.5 million vials of drugs that the company that you guys had said may not be sterile. And there were U.S. inspectors that discovered this at a Teva production plant in California. I think they were medicine used to help treat cancer. They may have contained mold contamination. What's the update on that?
Yeah, so first of all, just to correct a few facts, we actually ourselves discovered some environmental issues related to mold. It was not the case that the products were not sterile. And we did recalls in the first quarter and the second quarter. And that's something we did based on our own internal investigations. And then following that, we had an FDA inspection, which resulted in a 483. And we are now addressing all the points raised in the 483, working together with FDA to secure that we get all the remediation done. And the factory is still in operation from the point of view we're still packaging and shipping products, but in the sterile area, in order to make sure that the environment is in complete and perfect compliance, we have stopped manufacturing for a shorter period where we're doing remediation, and we expect to be back manufacturing here at the end of the quarter, and this is all done in close collaboration with FDA.
How far along are you in working out all of those issues? How long do you think you will be collaborating with the FDA?
So some of these issues take, you know, a shorter period to correct. Other issues take a longer period. So typically when you have a situation like this, before you reach a complete remediation, it can be 1 to 2 years, but that doesn't mean that you can't be manufacturing and supplying your patients in the meantime.
What's the cost to the company because of this, the downtime as well as the fixes?
So it's relatively insignificant. It's not a major manufacturing site. It's not a major part of our revenues. So the consequences are basically included in our accounting for the third quarter.
Hey, and also one of the things that we've been watching, and I want to get you to weigh in on, is Novartis considering selling or spinning off its Sandoz generic drug business. How do you view that? Is that a good thing? Is it something that you're interested in purchasing?
So I view it as something, and of course you have to ask them why they're doing it. I wouldn't know that. But if I just look at it from the outside, it reminds me of what Pfizer did with their Optum unit. They basically had some generic and old products that they spun out and put together with Mylan into Viatris. And I think it looks like Novartis doing the same. And one of the, you could say, arguments you've heard is that, of course, you get better ratios, you get better growth ratios. If you have an old business that you spin off and you keep your innovative specialty business, then your numbers from that point of view will look better, and that might be the motivation. In terms of us thinking about Sandoz, we are not really looking into it. We don't have any appetite for any major acquisition simply due to the fact that we are focusing on reducing our debt.
Right.
So it's not something we would be interested in.
Hey, Cor, I want to get your thoughts on why you're planning the $4 billion in ESG bonds tied to medicine access. Why go the ESG route with these bonds?
Well, basically because we believe in doing good for the environment and doing good for patients. That's really the foundation of the company. We are the world's largest manufacturer of medicine. We sell more medicine per day than anybody else in the world. And we believe in doing good while doing that. So what we've decided to do is to issue these $4 billion in bonds. And just to explain that, we issue $4 billion in bonds 5, 7, 8 years out.
Right.
And we use all that money to repay debt, which is, 1, 2, 3, 4 years out. So it's really a question of moving some of the debt. And the reason why we do it is because our debt repayments in some of the coming years, for instance in 23, is more than the $2 billion plus cash flow we make every year. So that's just to explain why we are making
right.
a bond offering. We basically sell bonds in order to buy some other bonds so that we
right.
change the timing of the debt. The reason why we do sustainability-linked bonds is basically because we can do it and because it's good for society.
Well,
so what we do on the access side is really we commit to ensuring access to essential medicines in low- and middle-income countries. Now, essential medicines, that's a list of medicines that WHO has defined
right.
that are essential to healthcare.
Hey, Cord, just got about 20 seconds here. What are the metrics, though, and transparency that you will use to make sure that debt is ESG and working to meet your intended goals, just quickly?
Yeah, so it's already certified by external bodies that, are independent and that do this, the Independent Access to Medicine Foundation, the ISS ESG people. So they look at it and say, this makes sense, this is bona fide, this is something that will be measured and reported and that will help societies around the world. And the actual KPIs, one is to get more essential medicines registered in more of these low and middle income countries.
Okay. We got to run, unfortunately, Cor. Hopefully you'll come back and let us know how that's going. Cor Schultz, he's president and CEO at Teva Pharmaceuticals on the phone in New Jersey. It is the Bloomberg Big Take today. It's also the upcoming cover story, domestic cover story, Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's out tomorrow online at businessweek.com on the Bloomberg terminal. And Tim, it's about the impact the pandemic has really had on the American worker, for better or worse, and for better perhaps, in terms of some of the lasting leverage we could see when it comes to unemployment reform.
Josh Idelson wrote the story. He's labor reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us from the Bloomberg 960 studio in San Francisco. Josh, congratulations on a great story. Along with the Great Resignation and Striketober, jobless Americans are fighting for unemployment reform that could translate into lasting leverage, but it hasn't yet begun to translate. Take us into it.
Thanks for having me. We are at this rare, turbulent moment in the workplace in the U.S. You have workers who labored through the pandemic, who shouldered great risk to themselves and to their families and didn't get the compensation or the safety protections that they felt they deserved. You have workers who were benched involuntarily and saw an unemployment system that they thought should be available and should be reliable failing them. You have lots of workers, historic numbers, choosing to quit their jobs. So this is a moment of both exit and voice. Some people are leaving their job. Some people are trying to band together. And in the places where workers have a union in the United States. We're seeing large numbers of workers authorize strikes, making October Striketober, as some put it. So this is all playing out at a moment when we have perhaps the last big bill of the Democrats' last stretch for a while of being able to legislate unilaterally being wrangled over. And it's one that could make permanent changes in ways that would change workers' leverage, including the unemployment system, that there's a relatively unusual effort afoot right now to organize jobless workers to transform.
So Norm and Norma Rae moment. Everybody go back and Google that movie. But I mean, is this a big move forward then? Because we've seen unions, right, declining in power and in membership. But is this potentially a critical change when it comes to the power of the worker?
It's a moment of possibility. And in some ways, it has the flavor of 1945. The way one historian put it to me is, when you have a national mobilization, like a world war or a pandemic, you have all of these workers who get the country through it and bottle up some frustrations along the way, and then afterwards expect a debt to be paid back. We're in a different political moment, one where there's attention to essential workers and to inequality and to labor that hasn't been there at times. And we're in a moment where many workers, like people that I talked to in the film and TV industry over the past week, have higher expectations than they used to, have a different consciousness, both from the work they did during the pandemic, but also from their time out of work during the shutdowns, about the importance of their own time, mm-hmm. and feel unwilling to accept some of the things they did in the past in terms of how work dominates their schedules and encroaches on their personal lives.
Josh, for the story, you spoke to people in several different parts of the country. I'm wondering, though, the Washington, D.C. connection, the lawmakers who are really on the side of labor right now, Senator Ron Wyden, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, representative from New York, what are they doing?
So Wyden, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, told workers that he will fight like heck to get something that is at least a down payment on fundamental change to the unemployment system into the reconciliation bill. There are things that could be done that would address some of the issues that workers have been raising over the years and that some experts have been raising for years without a lot of attention in Washington. Areas like the exclusion of many workers from the unemployment system and right. the race among states to cut off benefits more quickly.
Well, and I always think it's important when we do a story like this, and you do it, is, and you go there, Josh, in terms of what the U.S. system is, maybe compared to what we see in other countries. And it's meager, right, in terms of the benefits compared to what other countries do for workers?
That's right. The maximum months that people can get benefits here are lower than you see elsewhere in peer OECD countries. It's a pretty stingy system in the U.S. And unemployment insurance, as stingy and unreliable as it is still controversial, in part because it does give people a little more leverage to hold out a little longer against a mediocre offer they don't want.
Well, that's what we see happening in the labor force right now, right? This imbalance between supply and demand. Companies telling us each and every day they're having trouble finding workers, yet workers aren't ready to get off the sidelines and go take those jobs.
Well, keep in mind, many workers don't qualify for unemployment benefits,
right.
and many circumstances where you leave your job don't qualify you to get the benefits, and many people who were receiving benefits now are no longer eligible, either because of the federal cutoff or because of state cutoffs that happened before that. But that said, there is research that where there are more unemployment benefits, workers in some cases are able to hold out and choose to hold out for jobs that pay a little better. And that, depending who you ask, is one of the best or worst things about having this system. So the fight about unemployment is in part a fight about leverage in mm-hmm. the labor market. And we did this cover story in part because right now there's a fight over workers' leverage that's happening on picket lines, and there's a fight over workers' leverage that's happening in Congress at the same time.
Well, and probably last question, Josh, but I am wondering about the political will, right? I mean, politicians are always thinking about their next ballot and also the support to keep their election or re-election races going. What is the political will to pick up on something like this? Because are these people who are fighting for some of these benefits, are these the people who really go out and vote?
That is part of why this organization, Unemployed Action, has come into existence, is that the jobless are not usually seen as a prominent political constituency that people have to cater to. And being unemployed is often not how someone wants to self-identify, and it's generally not something they want to continue to be true of them. And so this group has been struggling against the tide in many ways to create a forceful political constituency, and one that people continue to be active with even after they've personally found another job.
Hey, Josh, just in the last 30 seconds that we have with you, at what point will you know, at what point will we know if this is a moment like post-World War II in terms of power for the labor movement?
And just got about 20 seconds, Josh.
We're going to have to see what happens in Congress as well as on the picket lines over the next month. But labor has been in a real catch-22 of needing more members and needing legal change, and people are desperate for a way to break out of that.
All right, it's the domestic cover story of Bloomberg Business Week, and it's written by Bloomberg News labor reporter Josh Idelson, so be sure to check it out. It's also on the Bloomberg Terminal, and you can find it at Bloomberg.com and BusinessWeek.com.
Good story, Josh, and congratulations on the big take.
It just is another reminder of the pandemic impact on our world. All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we brought her in to talk about Robinhood, but we've really been talking about taxes and taxing billionaires behind the scenes around our table here in our studio.
Yeah, tax policy expert, too.
She knows Robinhood. She knows tax policy. She is our investing reporter at Bloomberg News here in our interactive broker studio. Let's talk, though, a little bit about Robinhood. It's down about 10.6% in today's trade, reported earnings after the close. I think it's below, right, easily its IPO price. So there you have it. Revenue fell short of Wall Street estimates, cryptocurrency transactions plunging from the preceding period. What do we need to know, Annie?
So Robinhood's earnings yesterday did disappoint, and you're seeing the effect on the share price today. Like you mentioned, the stock's down 10%. The real story was around crypto transaction revenue, which was 78% lower versus the previous quarter.
It's like it disappeared overnight.
Yeah. And the reason we saw that, of course, is there was this gigantic run-up in Dogecoin in Q2, and that kind of abated. So now the big question is, that users have is, will Robinhood add more cryptocurrencies? They want Shiba Inu coin, which is completely different from Dogecoin. And they've struck a more cautious approach.
Completely different, but still a joke to me.
Exactly.
People.
A different joke about Shiba Inus.
It's a meme coin, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like wrapped up in a crypto. Well,
I was particularly struck by the decline in crypto because Bitcoin's price had gone up.
Do any of us own it? No.
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 No. Okay.
Shiba? Shiba?
Shiba?
No Shiba, no Doge over here.
Okay.
But I was particularly struck by this when these earnings crossed yesterday because the price of Bitcoin had gone up by something along the lines of 40% since the company last reported earnings. And my thought was, okay, well, doesn't that get more people off the sidelines and more people trading crypto and more crypto revenue for the company? But no.
So across the boards, crypto volumes were down by around a little over 30% in this quarter, just across the boards in the industry. But Robinhood felt it particularly because they had even said in the second quarter that Dogecoin made up more than 60% of their crypto transaction revenue.
Wow.
So it wasn't just crypto trading generally. It was specifically this surge in Dogecoin that was juicing their transaction revenue in the second quarter. And now you've seen that abate. And then the other thing that's kind of spooking investors is the guidance that they gave. They gave some guidance in Q2 that, like, hey, Q3 will probably look a little bit quieter on the trading front. And they've given similar guidance for Q4 unless we have another crazy meme stock or meme crypto.
Is it because everybody's got back to work? Because I'm hearing everybody hasn't come back to work. So help me out here. Like, you know, I had a note and I was going to say, has the company peaked already?
I mean, they definitely went public at just the right time. I mean, they were going public when they were absolutely on fire coming off of Q1 with stocks and options going insane over GameStop and all the meme stock trading. And then Q2, you had this huge run up in Dogecoin, which they were ready to catch because they already offered Dogecoin. Coinbase didn't until June. So now that they're being a little bit more cautious in their approach on cryptos, and that now that there wasn't just one singular event that was quite like that in the third quarter, you're seeing a little bit of wobbliness.
It's that caution you write in your most recent story, Annie, that is playing out in terms of a tension between the safety that Robinhood is going for. It's in the crosshairs of regulators right now, and it doesn't really want to necessarily add every meme stock or every meme coin, the ability to trade there. So how is that playing out for investors if Robinhood doesn't embrace the Shiba Inus of the world?
That's a really good question. Robinhood has gone through this evolution where they're trying to show now and have made really big strides towards being a more established regulatory compliant brokerage. So they've done things like they've added customer service 24/7 or customer service calls 24/7. They've added some protections and bulked up in that area. And now they've got this problem of like they allow retail investors to ask questions on their earnings calls. And the top one was, when will you add more cryptos? And when will you add Shiba Inu coin? So they have this tension of trying to toe the line maybe a bit more on the regulatory front while also trying to placate these customers who really want, at least some of them, really want some meme tokens.
Well, and you did point out in your story the brokerage brought on about 21% more employees in the period compared with the second quarter. So engineers, customer support, and compliance. Who are we supposed to compare them against? Because the CEO or the CFO kind of warned that we don't expect our growth to be linear. We do think it's going to ebb and it's going to flow. It's going to be highly dependent on things like market conditions and volatility. So can we compare them with, I don't know, the trading floor of a big bank or one of the, you know, traditional brokerage, whether it's a Schwab or something? Who do we compare them against?
It's a bit of a tricky comparison because Schwab or Interactive Brokers are, of course, both retail trading platforms, but they have these other services. Particularly Schwab has a bank function. They earn tons of money from net interest income. So they have these other streams of revenue, whereas Robinhood is still mostly dependent just on transactions in cryptocurrencies, stocks, and options to earn its revenue.
Like it leaves them a little bit vulnerable, right?
Which it does to things like volatility. To when fortunes shift as far as how much people are trading, that impacts Robinhood a lot more than it would a company that is kind of cushioned by having other business lines.
What about those other business lines that Robinhood is interested in adding? Crypto wallets. I think it's Bloomberg Intelligence's Julie Chariel that has written about the idea of this becoming potentially a super app.
Yeah, Robinhood is really into this idea of becoming a financial super app, so offering more, like you said, crypto wallets. They reaffirmed last night in their earnings that they're looking to add retirement-type accounts, even though they didn't give a timeline for it. So they are trying to move forward on offering more and more products. But, you know, they're moving along on that. We haven't seen these launch, but we have the promise of those additional ideas.
Mauricio, who's a listener, says Doge is a meme coin. Sheeb is a meme of a meme, aka a scam coin. I mean, we don't know, right? We really don't know how all this stuff is going to play out.
Yeah, I mean,
or do we?
It is like a meme squared.
It's like Inception.
Yes, it's a meme Inception situation.
Oh my God, my brain hurts. Annie Massa, thank you so much. You always set stuff straight when it comes to this world. So thank you, Annie Massa. She's investing reporter here at Bloomberg News in our Interactive Broker studio. Among our most read stories on the Bloomberg, another one having to do with Hertz and Teslas. This time we're adding in Uber and Carvana. Let's get an update on this ongoing story from our own Eric Schatzker.
He's editor at large at Bloomberg News. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. So the big news earlier this week was, of course, Hertz buying 100,000 Teslas over the next 14 months. Now it's partnering with Uber to provide Teslas to Uber drivers. How's it going to work out, Eric?
Quite simply, Uber drivers are going to rent Teslas from Hertz. Not quite the same way you and I rent Teslas or will rent Teslas perhaps from Hertz, but pretty close. Instead of it being a day-by-day rate, there's going to be a weekly rate. It starts at $324. It's going down to $299. And the sales pitch to the Uber driver goes something like this. Right now, you've got to bring your own car. And if you want to drive an EV, you have to bring your own EV. That means, generally speaking, you have to go to Tesla. Perhaps you could go to GM. Perhaps you could go to a few other companies. But you're probably going to lease it or you're going to buy it and finance it with a bank. You're going to have to make payments. You're going to have to maintain it. You're going to have to get insurance. You're going to have to do all the things that those of us who own cars do. And in addition to sitting behind the wheel for 12 hours a day, that's not so much fun. And it's a hassle. And the idea being, if you pay this weekly rate, you get rid of all that stuff. Hertz takes care of that for you. All you have to do is show up to the Hertz location, take the car, go out, do you, you know, pick up your riders, complete your trips, and drop the car back off. And furthermore, I should add that Uber, because it wants to go green, Dara Khosrowshahi, the CEO, has some pretty big ambitions when it comes to fighting climate change, is paying Uber drivers $1 per ride, up to a maximum of $4,000 per year. And if you, the Uber customer, chooses to go green, the driver gets an extra 50 cents. So in many cases, it could actually work out to the driver's financial benefit to do this as opposed to buying or leasing.
Win-win, it sounds like, certainly for the Uber drivers.
Yes, yes. You know, at the very, very, very least, even if it's a wash financially, think of all the hassle you give up.
You know, I have to say this story, I am fascinated by the Tesla component, Eric, but I am so fascinated by what's going on at Hertz and how they are redesigning that company just a few months out of bankruptcy and thinking about what they want to be going forward. It's not like your father's rental car company.
No, these guys are not old hands at the car rental business. They're hedge fund people. They're private equity people. They look at this with a fresh set of eyes and question every single aspect of the business model, as opposed to getting up every morning and thinking, oh, I'll just do what I did yesterday.
Well, but how much of it is Mark Fields, too, who is kind of your old car guy, right? I know he now works for TPG, but how much of what's going on is Mark's vision as well?
Well, he's the interim CEO, and right, it's not clear how long he's going to last at Hertz. He is clearly... Well, he is most definitely a part of the execution. Mm-hmm. He's responsible for making this happen. But the ideas actually came from the financial guys. They concocted these ideas and nurtured them as they were contemplating whether to make a bid during the Hertz bankruptcy auction. They put in a $6 billion bid. It was very competitive. Many people thought perhaps they were overpaying. And now it looks like an awfully good deal.
I keep thinking of Jim Coulter, who we talked to at when we were at Stanford, and you know, the Rise Fund. Like he's thinking about climate. He's thinking about disruption, certainly, and the impact on our environment. And I just feel like he can see that riding over this.
Mark Field said it to me this morning. He said, "We are trying to disrupt ourselves, and hopefully, then disrupting the industry."
Eric, where does Carvana come into this?
Carvana comes at the back end. If you think about the car rental business being three principal components, buying cars, renting cars, and then selling cars, Carvana comes in on the selling part. Up until now, Hertz has been disposing or exiting vehicles, as they like to say, either by selling them off at Hertz locations, which is not a bad business, but also getting rid of them through wholesalers or through auctions. And those are bad businesses because those cars tend not to sell at high prices. They give up a lot to the middlemen. and the recovery is low. And of course, if you have low recovery on the back end, your profit margins overall deteriorate. The idea by partnering with Carvana, home of the car vending machine, is that you'll get a much higher resale price even after Carvana's commission by going direct to consumer. So the same DTC concept that is animating a company like Nike is now actually helping to improve margins at Hertz.
Did you use the word or phrase asset utilization yet?
We haven't used asset utilization.
Why is this important?
Well, because one of the missions when you're renting cars is to keep them on the road as much as possible. Goes without saying. However, if many of your customers only want a car on the weekend or infrequently, you've got to find something to do with that car during the week. So think about it this way. A leisure customer, like myself perhaps, might go and rent a Model 3 for the weekend. And then the Uber driver takes over and uses that car from Monday to Friday. Thus, the car is busy 7 days a week, and Hertz comes out on top.
That's good asset utilization, right?
Yes, maximal asset utilization.
Hey, Eric.
Go ahead.
Does it lead to more sales of Tesla vehicles beyond the 100,000 that you reported on Monday?
Well, there's clearly an implication that it might, because in the, you know, as part of the Uber agreement, there's 50,000 cars set aside for Uber drivers, as many as 50,000 between now and the end of 2023, but there's the potential to extend it to 150,000. These are all Teslas. It's an exclusive deal with Uber to rent Teslas to drivers. So, yes, potentially many more Teslas down the road.
Yes or no? Should we be watching Avis next move?
Avis is watching Avis, that's for sure.
Eric Schatzker, great stuff. This is Bloomberg.
I'm driving in my car.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no. This is not a toy.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive, stay in prison.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Great. Definitely a different market picture that we've seen in the last hour or so, because we were bouncing around a little bit, but we have fallen off our highs, really taking a leg down and taking another leg down as we get closer to that closing bell. Charlie, of course, breaking down the numbers. The NASDAQ just barely holding on to a 0.2% gain after the NASDAQ 100. We did see hit a record earlier in the session, an all-time high, propelled by some of those big tech names, Microsoft and Google among them, which has really provided a lot of momentum. Let's get to the drive to the close.
Barry James is the president, CEO, and portfolio manager at James Investment Research. He joins us on the phone from Alpha, Ohio. Barry, it's great to have you. I want to get your overall thoughts on the market before we get to your stock picks. How do you trade a market like this?
I think we're in a rotation period. I see a confluence like the Mississippi and Missouri rivers where they meet. You got a green river and a brown river, and then it becomes a straight brown river after that. And that's kind of where we are. The COVID is looking like it's coming back down. Inflation's a problem. Bottlenecks are a problem. Rates, even though they're down today, have been heading higher, and the economy's a little more normal. So I think we have this transition from the tech area, from the growth area, from the large cap, into the cyclical value and smaller types of stocks, and that's where I would be focusing today.
And yet, you say that about rotation from tech, and yet everybody's been all in on Google and Microsoft today.
You're 100% right, and it's kind of like these big storms on East and West Coast. You know, something can come up that totally changes everything for the moment, and that big thing is interest rates. If you just follow the bouncing ball, as the rates go down, tech goes up, rates go up, tech goes down. So, it's maybe a one-off. I don't know.
Right. Well, what is, though, the smart correlation? Because also higher interest rates can mean an improving economy, and those companies stand to benefit as much as anything else of a reopening of the economy. Obviously, supply chains and inflation fears aside, I mean, we saw companies like McDonald's and Coca-Cola being able to push higher prices through.
That's exactly right, and that's exactly what we're looking for. And like our fund, the Golden Rainbow Fund, we're trying to find companies that have pricing power. And if they don't, and the easy way to do that is to look at the operating margins and can they really give them a boost. That's kind of the behind-the-scenes type of numbers to look at. But without that, the companies are going to really be hurting, that's for sure.
Why specifically are you concerned about stagflation? What are the signs that you're seeing that are telling you that we could be in a stagflationary period?
It's very interesting. I got a job offer at McDonald's yesterday, you know, in my bag. They said to come work for us. and then a lady.
Are you serious? Or are you just having some fun?
No, that's just actually. I mean, they had it there. They're giving everybody that goes through their drive
because they're looking for workers.
And a college student told a professor around here. He says they asked one question at the interview: "What's your size?" But anyway, that is an indication that, you know, we're going to have higher wages. You see it all over the place, and so that's one side of it. Stagflation is maybe a little bit of a strong term, I would say, just because you've got, you know, consumers with 140 some odd trillion dollars that they have that they can spend, and you have all these companies are needing to expand. So those should continue to keep the economy going, but it will be more expensive. And the lady that works up, you know, at the front up here at my office, she said she went to get a roast, and it was like $30 for a small roast. And she says, well, yeah, I guess we won't be having roast for dinner.
No, people are talking about Thanksgiving. Get ready to pay up. You know, we often see some maybe a price tick because of the demand or just because people know we got to buy turkeys and all that good stuff. But because of some of the concerns about the supply chains that we are going to see higher prices. Hey, economic news. You've got a Fed meeting just around the corner. We get a read on GDP tomorrow. How might that impact investor sentiment?
I think everybody knows the Fed is going to, you know, taper. Mm-hmm. But maybe they'll believe them this time. I'm not sure. But as we've seen before, the last, you know, taper back in 13 or so, it had a very short-term impact and then rebounded. So I don't think it's going to have that much of a call on things, to be honest. Maybe a short-term, and maybe that's what today is all about, you know, in anticipation of that. But
yeah.
Probably not a long-term thing.
Well, I promised we'd get to some of your stock picks, and I want to start with an Ohio company where you're joining us from, Fifth Third Bank, Fifth Third Bank Corp. Why a pick for you?
Well, it's a really well-run company. I don't have any inside information, but they have a history of beating, you know, their estimates, both the top and bottom line. Looks like loan growth is picking up again. You know, if we do have this Fed tapering, pushing rates up is always a good play for the banks. Not obviously today, but this is maybe a better chance to do some buying. So those are the areas, and it tends to focus Midwest, Southeast, which are very, very strong areas. So it has the pieces of the puzzle, and it's more of the cyclical type of stock that we're looking for right now.
Got another name for us?
Yeah, well, you were talking about the shipping.
Yeah.
And we're like Old Dominion. Maybe it's not, you know, the guys right at the port, but
right.
They do more interregional and multi-regional type of hauls. But they've done real heavy investing in their employees and equipment, and they're really keeping the people that they have, which a lot of trucking companies are having difficulty doing. And we really see that they have, you know, gas surcharges and whatever. So they have great pricing power. So we believe that, you know, their high operating margins and the free cash flow margins and
right,
those sorts of things are good for the future.
Old Dominion on a tear this year. It's up almost 66% as we speak. Hey, we got to run. Barry, thank you so much. Barry James getting an offer to go work at McDonald's. President and CEO and portfolio manager over at James Investment Research, joining us on the phone from Alpha, Ohio. But that is our world that we live in.
That really speaks to the way that companies are looking for workers right now. He's going through the drive-thru. He's getting an offer for a job.
Right. They're desperate. We see it big time, and we see it certainly at some of those entry levels, you would say, or lower positions. We definitely have heard it from some of the CEOs that we've talked to.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth. and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.